Today's episode deals with violence or crimes committed against a child. It will not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is highly advised. Hello, and welcome back to Evil Olive for episode 9 of the Matthew Hoffman case. It was a scene out of a movie. There was blood everywhere in the house that indicated a murder or murders had taken place, but there were no bodies. A mother lived in the house with her two children, but they were nowhere to be found. As detectives quickly started their search efforts and investigation, nothing could prepare them for how the case was going to unfold. Larry Maynard and Tina Herman met in 1993. Larry was just 15 years old and saw Tina and thought she was beautiful. Tina was also 15 years old as well. The two fell in love quickly and soon began dating. After they graduated high school, they got an apartment together, and soon Tina became pregnant with their first child. Their child was due in May 1997, but much to their surprise, their baby came 6 weeks early. Their baby girl, Sarah Maynard, was born on April 1st, 1997. Although she started out small, Sarah fought and was a strong little baby girl. She continued to grow and continued to gain weight and was a healthy girl that could be taken home by her parents. Both her father, Larry, and her mother, Tina, adored her and cherished every moment with her. Sarah was a happy child and had energy to spare. Sarah was also athletic like her mother. Not even 2 years later, Sarah became a big sister to her little brother, Cody Maynard. He too was born premature, but was strong and fought just like his older sister. He was a little soldier. Soon after he gained enough weight, he was sent home with his mother and father to live his happy life. Both Tina and Larry did not come from wealthy families. They did not have things given to them, and they had to work hard for everything that they had. This led to Larry taking a trucking job that kept him away from the home for long periods of time, and eventually led to him and Tina divorcing. Larry still was an active father and loved his kids dearly. Tina and Larry had their arguments, but they never let the kids be in the middle. They always put their children first. No matter what, the kids were never used against either parent during their divorce. Even after their divorce, Larry still loved Tina dearly. It was his first love and the mother of his children. How could he not love her? Tina was a hardworking mom that loved her children dearly. Everything she did was for them. She went to their games, practices, and other functions that she could attend. This is what led her to getting a home in Apple Valley, a nice community in Ohio that she could raise her children in. At this time, Larry had moved with his new wife and son to Florida due to his trucking job. At first, Tina thought about moving to Florida to have her kids be closer to their father, Larry, but realized that Apple Valley was a great place to raise a family. It was near a lake, there were beaches, and areas for the kids to swim in the summer. It was perfect. The entire community was encased with trees and had a natural playground for the kids. It was everything she wanted for her and her children. After moving into the home in the Apple Valley community in Ohio, she became friends with Stephanie Sprang, who just lived down the street from her in the same neighborhood. They hung out, went shopping, watched each other's children, and spent a lot of time together. Stephanie had three kids of her own, and Tina had her two children. Cody and Sarah would often play with them. At this time, Cody was playing baseball, and Sarah was playing softball. Both kids were doing well in school. Sarah was 13, loving life, and her little brother Cody was 11, doing great at baseball. After Tina moved to the Apple Valley area, Larry moved back closer to the area as well. He had a job opportunity that allowed him to see his family more. He moved with his wife and his family and was now able to see his children more than ever. It was perfect for both Larry and Tina. As stated in the book, The Girl in the Leaves, Larry and Cody had one of their best memories in the summer of 2010. Cody had always asked his dad to take him night fishing. And so one night in that summer, Larry did just that. He loaded up everything, to the poles and the bait, to a cooler full of food. Not too long after that, he and his daughter and son, both Sarah and Cody, went to the zoo lights together. They had a spectacular time, and they all enjoyed every moment of it. Larry was happy to be closer with his children and spend more time with them than ever. November 10th, 2010, started like every normal day. Tina's boyfriend Greg had gotten up early to go to work and left around 3 a.m. A while later, both of her children got up and got ready for school. After the children left for school, Tina decided to go look for apartments with her friend Stephanie Sprang. It was at this time people found out that Tina and Greg were no longer going to be together. But before going to look at apartments with her friend Stephanie, Tina had some errands to run. She went to the grocery store and the tanning salon and came back to the house with her friend Stephanie. This is where things took a very strange turn. Later that afternoon, Tina was supposed to go to work at the Dairy Queen. However, she never showed up. Her friend and boss, Valerie, was concerned and phoned the police station to inform them that Tina did not show up for her shift, and it was uncharacteristic of her. The police took the report and then later went to the house, but no one answered. They went back a few hours later and saw that there was a truck in the driveway and the lights in the house were on, but still, no one answered again. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary or unusual. Therefore, the police officer left. By the next day on November 11th, Tina failed to show up for work a second day in a row. Once again, her manager and friend Valerie knew something wasn't right. She had tried to contact Tina, but didn't receive any response back. She phoned the police again to make a report. After receiving this message, the police decided to look into the school that Sarah and Cody attended to see if the children were there. If the children were there, that meant everything was fine and maybe the mother just wasn't getting back to the manager. However, much to their surprise, Sarah and Cody were not at school that day on November 11th. Both children were unexcused. This alone was strange. But when Valerie called back, she informed the police that Tina's friend from down the road, Stephanie, was missing as well. Valerie knew at that point something was really not right. She drove to Tina's house and managed to get into her home by removing a screen from one of the windows in the back. Once she entered the house, what she saw horrified her. She immediately ran out of the house and phoned the police. While on the phone, she explained to the police that she had let herself into Tina's home because she was worried, But when she entered, there was blood everywhere. The police arrived shortly after and could not believe what they saw. When they entered the home, they could see there were multiple blood stains on the ground and the carpet. As they ventured further through the house, they could see one of the back bedrooms had a large blood stain as well. The bathroom was covered in blood, and there was cleaning agents all over the counter. Through the hallway and from the bedroom and the living room, there were drag marks all over the ground. The police immediately knew they were dealing with grave injuries of a person or persons. But where were the bodies? Where did all this blood come from? And where were the people that lived there? The mother and her two children, 13-year-old Sarah and 11-year-old Cody. The police searched the house for clues, but everything they found led to more questions than answers. There was a Jeep parked in the garage, but it did not belong to Tina. It was her friend Stephanie's. Why was the Jeep in the garage? In addition, Tina's pickup truck was missing. Where could it have gone? Also, the garage door was not fully closed. It was as if the garage door was broken and only half of it touched the ground, while the other part was partially open. As the police further went through the house, they knew something horrific took place in the bathroom. The amount of blood in the bathroom could not have come from just one person. It had to be multiple people. But once again, there were no bodies. Therefore, the search began for all four missing people: Tina Herman and her two children, Cody and Sarah, and Tina's best friend from down the street, Stephanie Sprang. As the police searched through the home more, they went back through the garage. They noticed a bag on the ground. It was a plastic Walmart bag that contained a tarp and garbage bags. One of the detectives said that this could possibly be a bag that the suspect had left behind and forgot by mistake. Therefore, they went to the nearest Walmart to pull the surveillance footage from the night before to see if they can find anything that matched what was bought in the bag. While some officers went to Walmart to review the surveillance footage, others interviewed other suspects as well, or persons of interest, one of which was Tina's boyfriend, Greg. However, his alibi checked out. Another person of interest was Stephanie's boyfriend, but his alibi checked out as well. The police were stumped. They had no leads to go off of. All they had, as a last hope, was the Walmart footage. When the police were able to review the surveillance footage from Walmart, they did in fact see a man walk in early that morning around 12 a.m. and he did purchase a tarp and garbage bags. However, he did pay with cash. Unfortunately, they weren't able to track who the man was in the video. But as they looked further, they saw that the surveillance from the parking lot showed the man getting into a car. It was a silver Toyota Yaris. At that point, the detectives knew that they could put this information into their database and see who in the area owned a car that matched that description. After putting the information of the car into their database, they came up with a name: Matthew Hoffman. 30-year-old Matthew Hoffman lived on Columbus Road in Mount Vernon, Ohio. He lived in his house with his girlfriend, who we will call Jane, and her son, who we will call Michael. Things between Jane and Matthew were fine and were like any normal relationship. They seemed to get along great, and Matthew enjoyed Jane's son, Michael, They seemed like a nice family. Many people that knew Matthew stated that he was a nice guy and never caused any problems. Many of the parents in the neighborhood would allow their children to go over to Matthew's house and have sleepovers with little Michael. They also would go over during the day to play football in the yard or ride on their bikes. None of the parents in the neighborhood suspected anything bad or out of the ordinary from Matthew. That was until the end of the summer in 2010. Neighbors of Matthew started to notice odd behavior. They knew that he was a tree trimmer and enjoyed nature and loved trees, but not to the extent that Matthew took it to. Matthew was seen perched in trees in his property for hours at a time. He started to make hammocks and would lay in the trees for hours. Matthew had also started to become more aggressive and violent. He was irritable and mean, and the neighbors started to notice. Even Jane, his girlfriend, who was usually talkative and friendly with the neighbors, was no longer seen by them. Typically, she would walk to the neighbors' houses to say hi or hello, but Jane stopped going by. Initially, it was just the time that Matthew had spent in the trees on his property that was strange to the neighbors. But it wasn't long until neighbors started to notice more odd and violent behavior. One of the neighbors stated that they saw Matthew setting traps on his property, but did not know what they were for or why he was doing it. One day, Matthew was confronted by one of his neighbors about the traps that he was setting on his property, and he stated that it was for the squirrels. Not thinking too much into it, the neighbor assumed it was to keep the squirrels off his property. But then Matthew continued to speak, and the words that came out of his mouth shocked his neighbor. Matthew stated that he was catching and killing the squirrels so he could eat them. The neighbor thought that this was extremely strange, as there was no need to catch and eat the squirrels, but also knew it was not unheard of for people. From that point, the gossip started, and many neighbors knew of Matthew's behavior, and they all agreed it was out of the ordinary and to keep the children away. The parents no longer let their children play at Matthew's house with Michael or let them spend the night over there any longer. Jane and her son Michael still lived in the house during this time, even when he was catching and killing the squirrels. It wasn't until October 2010 that things became so bad that Jane was forced to leave. Matthew and Jane had gotten into a fight, and Matthew strangled Jane. She was so terrified of his actions and his behavior that she left shortly after this incident with her son. This incident just further cemented the neighbors' concerns. The neighbors continued to keep a close eye on Matthew to see if anything strange was happening. They still saw him climbing up in the trees, perching there for hours, and laying in his hammocks, but nothing more. Not long after Matthew and Jane broke up, Matthew's tree trimming employer found out about what happened between him and his girlfriend. This led to his employer to also find out about Matthew's past that he had and that he had originally lied about. It turned out that 10 years earlier, Matthew was convicted of arson. While he was living in Colorado, Matthew had burglarized a home, and to cover up the scene of the crime and dispose of all the evidence, he set the home on fire. The home was a condominium that housed several families. Thankfully, all the families were able to get out unharmed. Matthew was convicted of arson and sent to prison for 8 years, but he only served 6. After which, he moved to Ohio, to Mount Vernon. After the dispute with his girlfriend Jane, his employer found out about the arson and immediately terminated him. To make matters worse, Matthew's power had just been shut off as well. Matthew was now alone, jobless, and his power was shut off. A man with nothing to lose is someone to especially fear. Although the neighbors knew that he was strange and labeled him a weirdo, they never thought that he would be capable of the atrocities that he was later convicted of. After the police were scouring the scene of the house, collecting evidence, an officer found Tina's pickup truck down the road. After he made his initial report regarding the abandoned vehicle, the officers back at the scene decided to go check it out. When they went to the truck, they didn't find anything out of the ordinary. However, they did find gas cans in the back. Why were there gas cans there? As they further investigated, they noticed that the same police officer that had found the abandoned truck of Tina's had made another report about a car that was down the road. It was a silver Toyota Yaris. The officer had went up to the car and asked what the gentleman was doing there. He said he was there to pick up his girlfriend, Sarah. Mind you, the 13-year-old girl that is missing, her name is Sarah. Once the police read this report, they knew that that silver Toyota Yaris that officer had confronted was the same man in the video of the Walmart surveillance footage that bought the blue tarp and the garbage bags. They knew Matthew Hoffman had something to do with the crime scene at the house. On November 14th, 2010, Judge Paul Spurgin signed a warrant at 6 a.m. against Matthew Hoffman. Multiple units geared up and went to the house on Columbus Road in Ohio, and they entered the residence with force. Matthew Hoffman was taken into custody without incident. As the officers searched the house, they saw shopping bags full of leaves piled on top of one another and stacked against the walls until they reached the ceiling. There were piles of leaves throughout the house, and it looked like though the bags of leaves were almost used as insulation. They were inside every room and closet. An officer spotted a desk in front of a door and decided to move it. They opened the door and they saw the stairs that led down into an unfinished basement of the house. They entered the area and searched room by room until an officer saw that there was a bed of leaves and an imprint of a person laying on them. The officer yelled for the individual to put their hands up, and they couldn't believe what they saw. It was Sarah Maynard, bound and gagged, lying on a bed of leaves. After the officers were able to untie her, the only words Sarah spoke were, quote, "I have to go to school," end quote. The officers assured her that she did not have to go to school that day. They asked her if anyone else was with her, meaning her brother Cody, her mother Tina, or her mother's friend Stephanie, and she stated that they weren't. Sarah was taken to the hospital where she underwent tests and gave statements to the police. It was discovered that while she was kidnapped, she was molested and sexually assaulted. Larry Maynard, Sarah's father, received the call that his daughter was alive and was beyond grateful. But he couldn't help but feel bad that no one could locate his son or his ex-wife. After Matthew was taken into custody, he refused to communicate with the officers. He only motioned that his heart was broken with his hands and didn't speak a word. When he did speak, he stated that he had no recollection of what happened, only that he knew the girl was in his house and that he must have done something bad for her to be there. The detectives tried every avenue to get him to talk, but it was to no avail. After Matthew was able to speak with his attorney, the attorney stated that Matthew would give up the locations of the bodies in exchange to have the death penalty taken off the table. The victims of the families were informed, and decided that it was in the best interest to agree to these terms, as they wanted to bury their loved ones. Once the deal was signed, Matthew drew a map of where the bodies were and gave it to the investigators. But before doing so, he gave the police a statement of what took place on that day, November 10th. This is his recollection of what happened. On November 9th, 2010, Matthew Hoffman was at his breaking point. He wanted and needed an escape from his life that was no longer existent. He lost his girlfriend due to his own actions. He lost his job due to his own lies, and was now alone and had no one. He was a person to be feared. He decided on November 9th to go out and look for a house to rob. There, in the small, quiet community of Apple Valley, was a house that had a garage door that was halfway broken and halfway open. He surveyed the house and knew it would be worth it. With him, he had a water bottle, food, and a sleeping bag. He decided to camp out for the night in the woods across the street from the house and wait until the morning to enter it. He fell asleep in the cold and woke up early the next morning while it was still dark outside and saw a car leaving the house. It was Tina's boyfriend, Greg. He had left for work that morning around 3 a.m. Matthew saw another truck in the driveway and decided to fall back asleep and wait for the other vehicle to leave before he entered the house. It was now November 10th, 2010. Everyone had left the house. Sarah and Cody had went to school. Tina's boyfriend Greg had left for work early that morning, and Tina left the house around 9:30. After Tina left, that was when Matthew entered the house. He went through things and rummaged, but had no idea what time anyone would be back. It was about noon, and Tina opened the door. She proceeded to put her grocery bags on the floor, and to her surprise, she saw a man in her house. Matthew panicked and proceeded to stab Tina with a hunting knife multiple times, killing her instantly. Little did Matthew know, Tina's friend Stephanie was right behind her, walking into the house. Stephanie entered the house and saw Matthew over Tina's body, brandishing a knife. She quickly tried to apprehend him, but she was no match for him. Just like Tina, she was small. Stephanie's friend tried to fight him off, but she ran to Sarah's bedroom. But Matthew caught her and stabbed her multiple times as well. At this point, both Tina and Stephanie were dead, and it was just Matthew alone in the house with them. Matthew became nervous and panicked. He drug Tina's body from the living room to the bathroom, with only one thing in mind. He would dismember her body. He put Tina's body in the bathtub and used his hunting knife to dismember her. As he was doing this, the hunting knife would not cut through the bones. He had to pull her apart and her body by the joints. Once he finished, he placed the body parts into a garbage bag and did the same thing to Tina's friend, Stephanie. After he was finished, he knew the crime scene needed to be cleaned, but he knew he could not clean it entirely. He took motor oil and poured it over the house and over the bloodstains on the carpet and planned to burn the house down, just as he did to the condominium in Colorado. But before he could enact his plan, he was interrupted. Later that afternoon, Sarah, who was 13, and Cody, who was just 11 years old, entered their home in Apple Valley. When both siblings entered the home, Cody went to take off his shoes, but both the kids saw that there was something on the floor. They noticed it was blood. Sadly, this was not the only strange thing the children noticed. Their mother, Tina, always said hello to them when they got to the door, but she was not there. They yelled for their mother, but they heard nothing. It was at that point that they knew something was really wrong. Both Cody and Sarah continued to yell, but they heard no reply. A few seconds later, a man came down the hallway and ran towards the both of them. Before they even knew what was going on, Matthew was there on top of both of them attacking them. Sarah managed to run past Matthew in the chaos and was able to get to her room. However, Sarah only remembers seeing her brother trying to run out the front door as she ran past the man. After she was in her room, it was only seconds later that the man came in and burst through the door. A struggle ensued, and he had cut her finger, and Sarah knew in that moment that she was going to die. But the man didn't kill her. He cut cords from things in her room, tied her up, and gagged her, all while screaming at her to be quiet and not to make a sound. He further bound Sarah up with ropes that he had found in the basement and placed a pillowcase over her head and put her in the kitchen. But before he left, the pillowcase had fallen off of Sarah's head. She was scared and was not sure what was going on or where her mother or brother was. All she could remember was the water from the bathroom running and the man going back and forth from the bathroom to the kitchen cabinet under the sink. He was grabbing cleaning supplies and would come out of the bathroom and would breathe heavily and be winded. As she sat there in the kitchen, she could only think about what was happening now and how to survive. She wanted her mother and to know where her brother went. Did they escape? Are they getting help? She also wondered where her dog was. The dog always barked, but there was no barking. Nothing was adding up, and she was trying to do everything to stay alive. The man continued to go back and forth from the bathroom to the kitchen for what seemed like hours. She would hear the water run and then shut off, and then a toilet flush. She was unaware of what was taking place in the bathroom down the hall. When the man was finished, he picked her up, blindfolded her, and placed her in a vehicle, which was Stephanie's Jeep. After she was in the Jeep, she could feel things around her, but she wasn't sure what they were. The man got into the Jeep and drove away, and after driving for a while, the man stopped and got out of the car. But before doing so, he made sure to tell Sarah that he would kill her if she screamed or tried to escape. Sarah, still scared and now cold and hungry, managed to loosen her blindfold and saw that there were garbage bags around her, and she didn't understand why. Later, the man arrived in a new car and took Sarah inside of a Toyota Yaris, leaving the garbage bags behind in the Jeep. He drove to his house just a few miles away and placed Sarah in his bathroom. He restrained her and left her to go to Walmart. That was where he bought tarps and garbage bags. It was now nearly 3 a.m. when he arrived back to the Jeep. He got into the vehicle and drove to a wooded area where he knew of a place to dispose of the garbage bags. After disposing of the trash bags, he went back to the house in Apple Valley and parked the Jeep back in the garage and took Tina's pickup truck. He wanted to use the truck to fill up a whole bunch of gas cans so he could bring them back to the house to burn it down. However, he forgot his Walmart bag inside the garage. After he left in the pickup truck, he started to drive, but the truck was having issues. Instead of getting caught, he decided to abandon the pickup truck on the side of the road and come back in the morning. He was able to walk back to his Toyota Yaris, drove home, and fell asleep because he was tired. In his home, he did see that 13-year-old Sarah was still tied up. After he went to bed, he woke up the next day and wanted to go back to the scene of the crime to cover up everything. But little did he know, the police were already there. They had surrounded the area with caution tape, and he saw it. He knew he couldn't fix it now. It was at that moment that a police officer walked up and asked him what he was doing down the road from the pickup that was abandoned. That's when he replied with, "I'm here to see my girlfriend, Sarah." He left and went back home and put Sarah in the basement of his house, which was cold, dark, and wet, onto a bed of leaves, where he sexually assaulted and molested her and bound her up and gagged her. Sarah was alone, hungry, starved, and afraid, and she had no idea what had happened to her entire family. In his interview with police, Matthew claimed that he was going to let Sarah go by giving her a little bit of freedom each day until she just ran away. He also had told Sarah that he would release her before Christmas. Many believed that that was never going to be happened. Sarah's father, Larry, speculated that this was more than just a robbery gone wrong. If Matthew really wanted to rob the house that Tina lived in, why didn't he leave with any of her belongings? She had gold necklaces, jewelry, money, and other items worth value. But when investigators told Larry none of the personal belongings were taken, including Tina and Stephanie's purse, he knew right then and there something more was happening. Larry assumed that possibly Tina had an interaction with Matthew prior, or that Matthew was possibly stalking his daughter. If he was there to rob, why didn't he take anything of value? The police had their suspect in custody, and Sarah was safe. But now they needed to locate the bodies of Cody, Tina, and Stephanie. On November 18th, 2010, detectives went to a forest called Cocosing Lake Wildlife outside Frederickson, Ohio. There they walked through the trees and found a large tree with an opening. The investigators were able to peer inside of the hole at the front of the tree. And when they looked inside, they saw that about from 5 feet up above the ground to all the way up to the top of the tree, it was hollow. As they continued to look, they saw the remnants of black garbage bags. But there was no way that Matthew would have been able to stuff these bags through this hole. A head could barely fit through. They looked up at the tree and saw at the top was a large opening between the branches. They realized that Matthew had used a pulley system with his tree trimmer equipment and sent the bags up by rope and dropped them down one by one into the tree. The detectives knew that they would not be able to appropriately take out the bags using the same system that Matthew did. So they had another hole cut in the front of the tree so they could safely remove all the bags. Once the bags were removed, the county coroner arrived on the scene and opened all the bags. To her horror, they were body parts of all the victims that had been missing. She placed the body parts together and placed them into official body bags and transported them to the coroner's office for further forensic testing and so that autopsies may be done. The coroner's report somewhat confirmed what Matthew had shared with the detectives, but there was discrepancies in what he had said. All the victims had multiple stab wounds pre- and post-mortem, indicating that they were in fact deceased prior to their dismemberment. Cody Maynard suffered blunt force trauma to the head, which was done to him as he tried to run out the front door. That was the last thing that Sarah remembered of her brother. She did not know if he was able to get away or not. Sadly, he was unable to escape his attacker. After Cody was hit on the head, he was stabbed multiple times and also had post-mortem stab wounds as well. In the days after discovering the bodies of Cody, Stephanie, and Tina, funerals were held for all of them, and hundreds of mourners came out to pay their respects. Larry, Cody and Sarah's father, expressed his gratitude towards all of the law enforcement individuals and volunteers that helped locate Sarah safely and help find his son Cody and ex-wife Tina. For Cody and Tina, two closed caskets were displayed at the funeral home. Tina's favorite flowers, sunflowers, lined the church, and Cody's casket was covered in paper baseballs with notes written on it from family, friends, and loved ones. Stephanie Spring had pictures for her memorial with her family, and her three children were in attendance, who she left behind. She was a bright and funny person who was loved by many, is what was stated. On January 3rd, 2011, Matthew Hoffman was indicted by a grand jury on 10 felony counts that included aggravated murder, aggravated burglary, kidnapping, sexual assault, tampering with evidence, and three charges for abuse of a corpse. During the hearing, many family members and loved ones spoke up and gave powerful victim impact statements. Larry Maynard's mother, Sarah and Cody's grandmother, Esther Maynard, stated this, quote, "I cry all the time. How could I not? Sweet Cody and his mom, Tina, were taken from us in the worst possible way. I find myself shaking inside. The only way to describe this pain is to say that it's as if I were shot in the heart by a shotgun. I beg that your days be long and full of agony as you deserve." End quote. Stephanie Spring's stepmother stated the following, quote, "My wish is that you remember, I will never forgive you. I will never forget that I look forward to the day you live eternally with the demons of hell. You may be torched and burned over and over forever. I will hate you to the day I die for what you have done to my family and my community." End quote. Larry, Cody's father and Tina's ex-husband, decided to read a portion of Matthew 18 from the New Testament. Quote, "At the time the disciples came to Jesus and asked, 'Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?' If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. Woe to the world because of the things that cause people to stumble." End quote. Larry hoped that using a verse from Matthew would invoke some type of response or remorse from Matthew Hoffman himself, but it did not. Larry went on to say, quote, "I could hold each of them in the palm of my hand. When God gave me these two beautiful kids, I knew I was responsible for more than just myself. These two precious babies depended on me and looked up to me as their father. A child's bond is like no other love or bond I believe you can have with anything else on earth. Matthew Hoffman, when you took my son from me by brutally stabbing him to death and then cutting up his body like a piece of meat, a majority of me died with him. Whatever they do to you today won't even be half as much as God will do to you on Judgment Day. I hope you are cast into the fiery pits of hell, you sorry excuse for a human being. I hope you wake up every day thinking of Tina, Cody, Sarah, and Stephanie. And I hope you get jailhouse justice. Maybe God can forgive someday, but I sure the hell never will." End quote. Even Sarah Maynard stood up to her captor and assailant in the middle of the courtroom. She stated, quote, "This is so sickening, Matthew, to know how you even had the guts to do this to this family. Stephanie was a great woman too. She watched Cody and me whenever my mom needed her to. All I am thinking about now is how sick and disgusting you are. I will never forget about Cody and my mom, Tina. I think Matthew is really stupid for killing the dog, too. What could we have possibly done to you, Matthew, to be treated like this? There is no reason why. Matthew, when you kidnapped me, I kept asking if you killed my mom and my brother, and you said don't worry about it. How could you possibly do this to a loving and caring family? Matthew, you must have been planning this for a really long time, because you have to have the skills and the time to do such a thing like this. I wonder if it even goes through your head, why did I do this? Now I'm going to prison for life. My brother was only 11 years old and his name was Cody. My mom was 32 years old and her name was Tina Herman. My mom did a lot for Cody and me. I didn't even get to say that I loved him one last time. I told my mom before I went to school that I loved her and for her to have a good day at work. I am very thankful for the guys who worked so hard to find me. Matthew, I don't know if you thought you were going to get away with this, but luckily didn't. I think Matthew was purposely trying to scare me and my family, but I'm not scared of you, Matthew. I'm going to stand up for myself and live my life. End quote. After all the victim impact statements were read aloud in court, the judge sentenced Matthew Hoffman to life in prison without the possibility of parole. After Matthew was sentenced and sent to prison, time went on, and so did life for Sarah. In the book, The Girl in the Leaves, Larry, Sarah's father, said this about Sarah, quote, "She has her good days and her bad days. She would have nightmares about someone trying to break into the house and take her away again. I had to reassure her that was not going to happen. I was here to protect her." End quote. Prior to the murders, Sarah played softball and she was a really good player. But she could no longer play. It reminded her of her mother and her little brother who played baseball. She ended up going to a different school, and while there, she decided to play volleyball and was good at it. She made friends on the team and was no longer the girl that something bad happened to. Life started to go back to normal for her. She went to counseling and sought help for her trauma that she endured, and it helped her. She was not going to let this tragic incident define her as a person or define her for the rest of her life. She wanted to take charge and rise above it, and she did just that. Sarah and her father created the Tina Rose B. Herman and Cody Alexander Maynard Healing Hearts Memorial Fund. It is a nonprofit that helps victims of violent crimes, similar to the one that Sarah went through. Both Sarah and her father wanted something good to come from this tragedy, and that is what they are hoping this organization will do. It was also a way to keep her mother and her brother's memory alive. Sarah and her father, Larry, were featured on the Today Show in February 2011. Sarah discussed how she found strength to survive and to not give up hope while she was kidnapped. And Larry discussed how his daughter and son missing affected him and how the death of his son and ex-wife still affect him. Sarah, towards the end of the interview, stated, quote, "My mom, she took really good care of us and made sure we had food, heat, and clothes. And Cody, he was just a really good brother, even if we fought." End quote. The anchor of the TV show went on to tell Sarah that she was an incredible human being and had so much strength for such a young girl. For privacy reasons, I will not discuss what Sarah is or is not doing right now with her life. This story took place back in 2010, and I'd like to keep it there. For her anonymity is the most important thing. Thank you for listening to episode 9 of Evil Olive. Take care. Until next time.